So good afternoon. Welcome to everyone here and those listening to us on the stations of Maine Public Radio. This is the 471st meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, and it comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine. And I'm George Look, the president of the Forum. The Mid-Coast Forum was founded in 1983. For the last 40 plus years, we have been hearing from an invited speaker each month on an issue related to U.S. foreign policy. You can listen to audios of past forum talks and get information about upcoming forum speakers on our website, midcoastforum.org. Recent forum talks are also on the websites of Maine Public Radio and the Maine Monitor. If you're interested in staying informed about key foreign affairs issues, please consider becoming a forum member. Our membership form is on the forum's website, and just click it on the link at the bottom of the homepage of the website. Our speaker today is Professor Elizabeth Cameron, who will be speaking on national security in an age of pandemic threats. Dr. Elizabeth Cameron is a professor of practice and senior advisor to the Pandemic Center at Brown University's School of Public Health. She also serves as a senior advisor for global health security for the Agency of International Development and is a practitioner senior fellow of the Miller Center at the University of Virginia. Dr. Cameron is a global leader in health, security, and biodefense. She has served for over two decades, both within and outside of government, working for greater emphasis on these issues. She spent two tours in the White House on the National Security Council staff, each time helping establish and lead the Directorate on Global Health Security and Biodefense. In this role, she built and led a robust team focused every day on preventing, detecting, and responding rapidly to biological crises. Dr. Cameron oversaw U.S. global COVID-19 response efforts and was instrumental in developing and launching the global health security agenda to address homeland and national security biological threats of all kinds. From 2010 to 2013, Dr. Cameron served as Office Director for Cooperative Threat Reduction and Senior Advisor to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear, Chemical, and Biological Defense Programs. For her work, she was awarded the Office of the Secretary of Defense Medal for Exceptional Civilian Service. From 2003 to 2010, she oversaw the expansion of the Department of State's Global Threat Reduction Programs and supported the expansion and extension of the Global Partnership Against the Spread of Weapons and Materials of Mass Destruction. Outside of government, Dr. Cameron was the Vice President for Biological Policy and Programs at the Nuclear Threat Initiative, where she was the architect of its programs aimed at countering biological catastrophes. At the Nuclear Threat Initiative, she helped lead the development of the first Global Health Security Index and worked to build international consensus for a new global organization for improving biosafety and biosecurity. Dr. Cameron holds a PhD in biology from the Human Genetics and Molecular Biology program at Johns Hopkins University and a Bachelor of Arts degree in biology from the University of Virginia. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Dr. Cameron has asked me to inform you that she will be speaking today entirely in her role at the Brown University Pandemic Center, and the views she expresses are her own. Beth, welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
Thank you, George. Thank you so much, George, and it's really a pleasure to be here today in Maine. I was looking back at the last time I was in Camden, and it was almost exactly two decades ago, so I'm excited to be here today with all of you. Thanks so much to the Mid-Coast Forum for inviting me, and thanks to all of our listeners online at the Maine National Public Radio. I'm going to speak to you today about the intersection of biological threats and national security threats. And I'm going to start by just recognizing that COVID-19, the pandemic that we all just lived through, was incredibly personal for everyone, everywhere, all at the same time. For me, this was intensely personal because I work on biological threats and pandemics, and we were all working to protect the people that we love and to save lives here and around the world. And I was walking back into the White House in January of 2021 thinking to myself, we've done so much work in this field. What do we still have left to do? What were we not able to do, and why? Why was that? So what I'm going to speak to you today about is in four parts. I'm going to talk a little bit about what happened. I'm going to talk about the biological threats that we face and why I believe they're increasing. I'm going to tell a little bit of a story about what's been happening over the past two decades to improve our preparedness for biological threats like pandemics. And then I'm going to talk about what we need to do about all of that to get better prepared for the future. But it wouldn't be a foreign policy forum if I didn't give you a few bottom lines up front. So the bottom lines up front for this talk are, number one, I hope to convince you that biological threats are increasing, that national security and global health security are inextricably linked, and that they always need to be on the agenda for leaders of the land, and they need to be discussed in situation rooms always. I believe that we're perhaps a little bit less well prepared for biological threats than we were in 2020 in at least a few ways, and I'm happy to talk a little bit about that and maybe debate with you in the Q&A. We need sustained attention and financing for global health security. There are definitely paths to a safer future, so I won't leave you in a pessimistic viewpoint as we leave. I'll leave you with some hope. In transition periods, we know that we're going to have a new president, whether it's President Harris or President Trump. These are particularly important and potentially dangerous times, so I think now is a really good time to be paying attention, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. So I'm just going to start by talking a little bit about what I mean by global health security. So when I use that term, what I mean is a biological threat, whether it's naturally occurring, whether it's accidentally released, like from a laboratory, or whether it's deliberately caused, like a bioterrorism attack or a state use of a biological weapon. All three of these things together constitute infectious disease threats that can cause a catastrophe, that could kill millions, perhaps even billions of people, that cost trillions of dollars, and could exacerbate political and economic instability. And it's important that these three elements are brought under one heading, because no matter what caused a pandemic threat or a biological threat of any kind, we need to be ready. And we won't always know at the beginning of an outbreak what caused it. So starting with what happened, just to bring everybody back into COVID-19 and the story, millions of people, including over 1 million Americans, lost their lives and their livelihoods. The United States and many other countries around the world hesitated in their response. It took several months for the Federal Emergency Management Agency to be put in charge of moving supplies around our country. We failed to have a united effort across our states. We didn't surge testing quickly enough, and that led people like Jenny Durkin, the former mayor of Seattle, to say that she and others like her and mayors around this country were flying blind. They didn't know where the virus was, so they didn't know how to target resources to fight it. We didn't have the pandemic supply chain that we needed. We didn't have the personal protective equipment that we needed. And we were slow to really recognize what had already happened by the time this threat had popped out in China. It was pretty much already here on a plane flying to the United States. The global economy lost trillions. Malign actors used the pandemic to traffic in mis and disinformation. And we ended up in a situation where life expectancy in this country and around the world dropped for the first time in decades, something that was not really fathomable to me heading into this pandemic. On my birthday, March 16th of 2020, the stock market took an incredible plunge. And at the same time, we were seeing hospitals overflowing around this country, partially because we didn't have good plans in place for managing the need for hospital beds across multiple cities and states in our country. I was getting calls from people to work on things that I'd never worked on before. How do we get oxygen to our own hospitals and around the world? How do we move personal protective equipment? How do we make sure we have enough for our healthcare workers? Ventilators, do we need them? How many of them do we need? And people were just rolling up their sleeves and trying to figure out these problems as they came. The Trump administration was walking away from the World Health Organization at this time. He was pulling back our seat from this table at a time when it was really important, in my opinion, for us to be there to shape our own peace and security and to shape the security of the world. And at the same time, we saw China and Russia working together in additional and new ways. There was also a lot of discussion about structure. It seemed like there was a bit of a chaotic response. I wasn't in the White House at this time, but it was unclear who was on first. There was a pivot from the Department of Health and Human Services to the White House and to different components of the White House. It wasn't clear. And the office that I had been asked and was privileged to lead under President Obama was disbanded 2 years after the Trump administration began. And I do believe that that contributed to some of the confusion. And of course, this became an election issue in 2020. So stepping back for a minute, this issue has been bipartisan for a really long time: pandemic preparedness, biological threat preparation. And for the last four administrations, from George W. Bush to Barack Obama to President Trump to Joe Biden, we saw our national security strategies and our national biodefense strategies paying attention to biological threats, whether naturally occurring, deliberate, or accidental. So there's been attention at the highest level of government for four administrations in a really bipartisan way, which leads you to maybe ask, so what happened? Why were we not able to do a better job with COVID? And also, what has been done and what is there to build from? So I'm going to leave that thought in your mind for just a second while I transition to talk a little bit about what I mean by biological threats, what we're facing right now, and why I think they're increasing, and why it matters to foreign policy. So we live in an age of biological threats. They're increasing because people live closer together, because people can move from one part of the world to another extremely quickly on planes, because people are living closer to animals, where disease threats can circulate, and there's an opportunity for them to pop out into humans and transmit sustainably, potentially causing a local outbreak, a regional epidemic, or a pandemic like COVID-19. We're also seeing that it's easier to make and modify biological agents, and that means, and that can be done for good reasons, to make vaccines, tests, and treatments for disease threats that we face, including pandemic threats, but also other disease threats. That is net positive, but at the same time, if we don't do that with biosafety measures in place, that's the ability to prevent an accidental release, or biosecurity measures in place, that's the ability to prevent a deliberate attack, we run the risk of seeing a pandemic threat made, created, or released that actually can set us back from our goals to prevent those very same threats. And I do think it's important to say that these technologies both mitigate pandemic risk and add pandemic risk. So, for example, there's no doubt that the ability to make DNA from scratch, DNA synthesis technology, artificial intelligence, and the biodesign tools that AI is making possible, those are going to be essential for developing new vaccines and treatments for diseases. But at the same time, those same technologies are going to make it easier to misuse technology. And so we really need to be mindful as we're thinking about building new tech to not only look at policies for oversight, but also to actually build into the technology guardrails against misuse. And the field of biosafety and biosecurity has been largely policy-focused and not very technologically focused. I think we could learn a little bit from the cybersecurity and other fields that have sort of baked those two things a little bit more closely together. So the goal, of course, is to stop outbreaks at the source. That's not always possible with a pandemic threat that transmits through a respiratory route. Someone can be on a plane relatively quickly. It may not be possible, but certainly you want to mitigate the harm. You want to lean forward fast. And this was a mantra that was repeated a lot when I was in the White House in the Obama administration. My boss, the National Security Advisor, Susan Rice, the Homeland Security Advisor, Lisa Monaco, and our principal deputy, Avril Haines, used this term in almost every meeting. What can we do as a national security community to look at a worst-case scenario and then to think to ourselves, what can we do to prevent every possible step from happening, to keep that from happening? That's something that the public health community doesn't do quite as much, and it's a place where the national security and the public health communities are coming closer together coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic. So where are we with preparedness? Well, we're not as prepared as we should be. In 2021, the Global Health Security Index, the second Global Health Security Index, was published. And this is a tool that's published by the Nuclear Threat Initiative in collaboration with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, and now also with the Brown Pandemic Center, where I work. And this index looks at 195 countries, and it looks at specific gaps, and it asks, how well are we doing to prevent, detect, and respond to an epidemic or a pandemic? It looks at lab capacity, it looks at workforce, looks at biosafety and biosecurity, looks at the healthcare system in a country. And the bottom line is that the average score for countries around the world is just 38.9 out of 100. And when you look at biosafety and biosecurity measures, the ability to prevent, detect, or respond to something accidental or deliberate, the scores drop even lower, down to 21 out of 100. In fact, only about 6% of countries have the ability to have publicly available data to suggest that they can oversee dual-use research, so research that might make a pathogen more transmissible or more virulent. We know that not all countries are doing research to make pathogens transmissible or more virulent, but the truth is we don't actually know how many countries are doing that work, and we don't really have an internationally agreed set of measures for looking at dual-use research and asking these kinds of questions. A lot was made out of the fact that in this index, the United States does really well. We're the top country, and yet we didn't do very well during the COVID pandemic by all accounts. One of the reasons for that is we have a lot, first of all, we didn't get an A. We probably got a low B, which I would call failing for our country. And in addition to that, we didn't use all of the capability that we had. And so some of the lessons coming out of COVID are about how to knit together all of that capacity and use it fast to best effect. And I'll talk a little bit about more about that in the recommendations at the end. So bottom line, we're underprepared for health emergencies, and we may be catastrophically underprepared for worst-case scenarios. And we're seeing additional threats popping out all the time. We know that since the COVID-19 pandemic emerged, many other local, regional, and global outbreaks have happened. Mpox in 2022. This morning, we're waking up to the news that clade 1 Mpox is in Central and East Africa. That's a more severe strain of Mpox than the one that circulated here in 2022. Many of you are probably reading about H5N1 pandemic influenza, which is circulating now in more mammals, including dairy cows as well as poultry, and infecting humans that work closely with those animals. Not yet a pandemic strain, but certainly something that people have their eye on. And we're seeing more cases of Ebola popping out as well. So all of this is going on in the background, but yet attention and political will has really shifted away from health security over the last couple of years as people are moving on from COVID-19. So you might ask yourself, you know, where are we? And to quote the great David Byrne from Talking Heads, how did I get here? So I'm going to tell a little bit of a story now, and every story has at least one great protagonist. And to be bipartisan, I'm going to choose two. One is Barack Obama, the 44th president of the United States, and one is George W. Bush, the 43rd president of the United States. So in 2005, George W. Bush put in place a strategy for flu pandemic preparedness and response. Coming out of the anthrax attacks in 2001 and the SARS pandemic in 2003, He put people into the White House who focused on medical personnel, biological experts who were looking inward at homeland biosecurity and looking externally at how can we help prepare people around the world, countries around the world. He had read John Barry's book, The Great Influenza, and been inspired by it. In 2009, not long after President Obama was elected, the H1N1 flu pandemic broke out. By all accounts, this was a fairly moderate pandemic, and it didn't turn into be something as devastating as COVID-19, but it really impacted the presidency for the next 8 years and the focus on this issue. And in 2011, coming out of that experience, President Obama said the following thing. He said, "We must come together to prevent and detect and fight every kind of biological danger, whether it's a pandemic like H1N1, a terrorist threat, or a treatable disease." This was a UN General Assembly speech in September of that year, and it was really important for two reasons. The first reason is because it brought together these fields, these silos, where people were focused on naturally occurring disease threats like H1N1, bioterrorist attacks, people like me sitting in the State Department and at that time in the Defense Department thinking about how we could prevent bad actors from misusing biology, and people who were focused on diseases that we already know how to treat, like HIV/AIDS, but we just weren't doing it as effectively as we could or getting countermeasures where they needed to go. So that was important, knitting together our communities and working to knit together funding and priorities from across the world. The second reason is that we knew there was a really large looming deadline that we were going to miss. So in June of 2012, every country in the world that's part of the World Health Assembly, so approximately 195 countries, were supposed to have agreed that they would be prepared for any disease threat that could cross borders, public health emergencies of international concern. This was a pretty wonky field in 2013, around the time that I showed up in the White House the first time. I think most people listening know now what a public health emergency of international concern is, thanks, unfortunately, to COVID-19. But we knew in 2011 that most countries weren't going to make this deadline that had been in place since 2005. And in fact, writing in 2014, Ambassador Rice said, look, 80% of countries missed this deadline. What's really important, though, is not only did 80% of countries miss it, did they say that they weren't prepared for a public health emergency of international concern, but many of those countries didn't actually know. And the reason they didn't know is because there weren't any metrics in place that were common that people knew. How do I know if my lab system is strong? How do I know if I can detect a disease threat fast? How do I know if I have good laboratory biosafety and biosecurity? There just weren't common measures for that. And there weren't any independent assessments where countries would walk into another country and say, how are you doing? Let's actually publish that information accountably, and maybe that'll help us focus. And that was really controversial in 2013. Countries did not want other countries or experts walking in and telling them how they were doing on this really important issue. And so we did two things. We looked internally at what we were doing in the United States across our programs at the State Department, at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, at the U.S. Agency for International Development, and at the Department of Defense, among a few others that were involved. And we asked, what if we put some measures in place so that we would know how effective we are in helping countries? The U.S. government agreed to that, and we actually ultimately put together a set of measures. And we got the Office of Management and Budget interested in this. OMB cares a lot about how the US government functions effectively. And that allowed us to really get high-level attention within the government. We had strong support from the White House. And ultimately, we took those measures and we went to a number of partner countries, over 30, and we talked to the World Health Organization. And we got a lot of support for considering the question, could we have a set of measures? Could we work with countries around the world and develop action plans that were specific to get prepared? And further, could we have these independent assessments so that everybody would know how everybody else is doing? So we launched that effort in February of 2014. And a few weeks later, the first cases of Ebola in West Africa came to light. And obviously that was bad for the world. 11,000 people died in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. And we found out that it had been circulating for months, undetected, since at least December of 2013. We also found out that the countries in West Africa weren't as prepared for Ebola as their neighboring countries in East and Central Africa. They hadn't seen the disease before. The cultural context was different. The U.S. government and other countries didn't have as many global health and health security programs operating in those countries. So they and we were flying blind. And these countries were sitting in a part of the world coming out of decades of civil war where there was a great potential for political instability. That really accelerated the effort that we'd been working on. So we had this problem that we'd been, you know, sort of inching forward since 2011, and then we had an opportunity as a world to move it ahead. And all of that really kickstarted the creation of metrics that now exist, independent peer assessments that now exist, and a lot of work to start highlighting what the gaps are. And that work continues, and it's been happening throughout the COVID pandemic, but of course, it's been slow and not well-resourced. It did, though, change the way that we talk about this. If you think about how to talk to a leader about the international health regulations and why countries need to get prepared, you start getting into a very wonky set of language. It's hard to get a leader in an elevator speech interested in meeting the deadlines required by the IHR. But if you tell them that every country needs to be able to prevent, detect, and respond to an infectious disease threat, it's a lot easier to sell. And if you tell them, why don't we have a map of our gaps so that people can fill them, so that our own parliaments know where they are, they start to get interested. So we put together a coalition of countries, and it still exists. It's called the Global Health Security Agenda, and it's been doing work for the last decade now in this area. At the same time, some structural changes happened in the White House. We looked at Ebola, and we looked at how there were people on the homeland security side looking domestically, people on the national security side looking globally. We had people who were experts in how to respond, and people who were experts in how to prepare, and they were sitting in different places, which meant that every week, when the National Security Advisor, at least every week, had her meeting, there wasn't one person who was high level who would always be talking about biological threats. There were many people buried one level beneath who would sometimes get a talking point into the discussion about biological threats. So President Obama and Susan Rice, the National Security Advisor, put together a directorate that I was privileged to lead in order to elevate that issue. We also created a transition exercise and an executive order that exists today that's still on the books about health security. So a lot of work happened. But clearly, there's still a lot to do when we look at what happened from 2020 until now with the COVID pandemic. So I want to spend just a few more minutes talking about where do we go from here. So what was missing in all of this? We had metrics, we had maps of the gaps, we had countries who cared, and we had a little bit of money. We were able to get another $1 billion to U.S. aid and CDC coming out of the Ebola pandemic that was future-facing from a Republican Congress to a Democratic president, which is pretty unprecedented at the time. What was missing was a systematic, rigorous, and well-financed global approach to filling those gaps. What was missing was regularized political will, so a way to get not just health ministers, but heads of state, foreign ministers, and defense ministers continually interested in this issue. We also didn't have systems for financing things like medical countermeasures development and delivery for all countries. We had some of those systems growing in high-income countries. We didn't have ways to get those out to the rest of the world, and that matters first and foremost to save lives, but also to decrease the likelihood that a disease will continue to spread and cause more dangerous variants. So it's in the United States' best interest for all kinds of reasons to invest in medical countermeasures development and delivery, not only for ourselves, but for the world. We also didn't have a very rigorous, transparent alert and surveillance system. Many of us were using a map that the Johns Hopkins University put together. And that map was put together by the private sector, by the academic sector, and with help from the Applied Physics Lab, because there wasn't a good map that we had at the government level or globally in the world. And that needs to change. A lot of work has been done since then. There's at least two seminal reports, the IPPR report, which was put together by former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and former New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark. The G20 high-level independent panel looked at how do we finance pandemic threats. And both of these reports tapped almost every expert that I know in this field over a two-year period and came out with a really similar and short list of things that we need to do, to include a high-level council of presidents, heads of state that meets regularly. That recommendation was not implemented. I think that it should be. A pandemic fund, the creation of a fund to help countries actually fill all of those gaps that they've been so busy identifying. That recommendation has been implemented, and the pandemic fund is getting ready to do its first resource mobilization this fall, in order not only to give grants to those countries, but to actually get the private sector more motivated to think and care about pandemic threats, and to get countries to think about how to get more focus and attention within their own domestic budgets. A pre-negotiated supplies platform, so a way to actually understand where some of these supplies, like personal protective equipment, like specific components for vaccines and therapeutics, to actually understand where those things are at any given time and where we might see shortages if we saw an emerging outbreak. And that pandemic supply sort of network is something the WHO is taking on. There are a number of other recommendations that were made. I won't go through all of them, but I will say that a lot of work is being done to implement them. It's really challenging because political will has really plummeted since 2021 when most of these recommendations came out. I will say, though, that on the research and development side, a place that the United States did well during the pandemic, there's been a lot of work on something called the 100 Days Mission. This is a plan that came out of the G7 and is now global that basically says for every virus that has the potential to become a pandemic threat, we will have countermeasures like vaccines, tests, and treatments ready to go. And that's a tall order. It's a bold goal. But when you think about the work that we were able to do in the United States looking at our preparedness for Middle East Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus, that work led us to have a vaccine that wasn't ready to go for COVID, but it was a candidate, it was a start, it was a place to begin. And so the goal is to have something in the freezer for every virus that can potentially cause a pandemic. And that goal is critical, but it's also severely underfunded. President Biden put in place a national security memorandum that also looks at some of these issues. Usually the first national security memorandum in a presidency stands up the National Security Council. That was the second memorandum for President Biden. The first one is about how we would work with the world and come back to work with our allies and partners on global health security and the COVID response. And it lays out a roadmap for the presidency that is still being implemented that looks at things like how will we get to sustainable financing? How will we fill some of the gaps that I've outlined in this talk? One of the many things that is outlined in that memorandum is that we need to update our national biodefense strategy, and that happened a couple of years ago. And one of the commitments that the US has now made is that we will help at least 50 countries to fill their gaps, and we will catalyze support and alignment for another 50 countries working with partners around the world. And we've also internalized creating the Directorate on Biodefense and Global Health Security that I helped lead, as well as a new Office of Pandemic Preparedness and Response. So for my just last couple of minutes, I'm just going to hit you quickly with what's next and what we need to do to get prepared. So number one, we have plans, many plans, but we really don't have playbooks that are adapted at the community level for what needs to happen. For example, we have guidance that comes in that says, here's what we need to do to safely open schools, but there's not really a great roadmap for communities that may have different needs and different values to take that information and use it to be able to safely keep their schools open in the next pandemic. I'm working on a project called the American Democracy and Health Security Initiative. That's a collaboration between the Brown Pandemic Center, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and the COVID Collaborative. It's a bipartisan effort, and the goal is to identify these kinds of gaps in states and communities around the country and to figure out where to go next and how to fill them We're working with a bunch of partners that we're calling lamplighters who are telling us what they did that worked. And I think this is really exciting, and we need to do more of this kind of work. We need to have predictable capacity. I've talked a lot about these gaps, but it's really sort of hit or miss whether countries are focused on them or not, depending on whether we're in the cycle of panic during the COVID pandemic or we're in the cycle of neglect, which is where most people think we are right now in terms of political attention to these issues. We need to work on this access to medical countermeasures question. And this is difficult because we need to have a really strong industrial base in our own country for pandemic supplies. We didn't have the ability to get personal protective equipment out fast to hospitals the way that we wanted to. We need to fix that ourselves. At the same time, we need to make sure that there's a sustainable market and access to those commodities for other countries, both for their security and for ours. There's been a lot of work done on vaccines at Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, for example, not much on tests, treatment, or PPE. So we don't really have great ways for low-income countries to get in line for those commodities and to be able to get them quickly. And then finally, last but certainly not least, we have a lot of work to do to reduce deliberate and accidental risks. The United States recently updated its own policy on dual-use research of concern, so research that could make a pathogen more transmissible or more virulent. We now have a stronger oversight policy, but we're one of very few countries that does, and there isn't really a roadmap for how to do that well. One piece of good news is that there are some funders who are interested in taking this issue on and saying, if we make a grant in the life sciences, we're going to ask for there to be an assessment of risk, and we're going to fund biosafety and biosecurity as part of that. And the Nuclear Threat Initiative has pioneered this. The Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation, which is a large funder of vaccine research, has agreed to sign it. And we need a lot more partners, private sector partners and philanthropic partners who fund research to sign on. We also have a new international organization focused on biosafety and biosecurity, and I'm excited about that. And so very, very last point here is transitions are dangerous times. H1N1 flu happened in the transition between President Bush to President Obama. Zika was surging in 2016 at the end of the Obama presidency. I was in the White House in 2017 as a civil servant. I transitioned between the Obama administration and the Trump administration, and we were watching H7N9 flu cases rise in China. This did not become a pandemic. We did see more human cases because we saw more cases in animals. This allowed me to get on the National Security Advisor's calendar and brief him about biological threats. So it was important for those reasons, but also because we didn't know what was going to happen with H7N9. And then, of course, we're facing H5N1 influenza today and a whole host of other threats. And so it's really important to keep our eye on these so that we can lean forward faster. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth. That's a tremendous amount to absorb all at once, because none of us think about these issues. I mean, it's your point exactly, that these are not the type of issues. While we're collecting questions from our people here today, I always take the advantage of being the moderator to ask the first question. I wonder if you could elaborate a little more on what the efforts are being made internationally by the WHO or other countries to address the same type of things that you're talking about here. I mean, we're trying to expand it to other countries. Is it coming in from others as well?
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of work happening internationally amongst partners and allies. So during the 2020 and 2021 timeframe, the WHO and most of the international organizations that work on global health-related issues got together and created an organization that they called the ACT Accelerator. And this was WHO, it was organizations like Gavi, which focuses on vaccines for kids traditionally. It was organizations like the Global Fund, which exists to help get medicines and treatments out the door to countries for HIV, AIDS, and malaria, and tuberculosis. And these organizations were coming together to pool their resources and their capabilities and expertise to figure out what to do about the COVID pandemic. And so now, there's a tremendous amount of work to figure out how to cement that effort. And in particular, there's a lot of conversation in Geneva right now about a new pandemic treaty, a pandemic accord. And there's been debate about the really hard issues, like how will high-income countries ensure that low-income countries have access. But I think that debate is incredibly healthy and important, because ultimately I think we'll get to a better place. So that's just one issue. Pandemic financing has been another, where health ministries and finance ministries in the G20 have created a new task force to look at the intersection of those things, so that we don't just have health ministers saying, help me, I need help, and no financing to actually fill the gaps. So those are just two examples.
Thank you very much. Someone asked here whether from COVID, did we learn anything that could improve public opinion on how to cope with pandemic, e.g. opposition to vaccines and masks? What did we learn?
Yeah, this is an incredibly hard issue, and it's one of the reasons that I'm working on this bipartisan effort to ask people what worked. One of the top questions that we're asking people in red, blue, and purple states is, how did you deal with flashpoint issues around masking, school closures, business opening, all of the things that divided communities and also, I think, siloed the way that we absorbed the pandemic in parts of the United States? So the answer to your question is, honestly, I'm not sure yet exactly how we're going to overcome polarization on some of these issues, but I think one way is to start thinking a little bit more about state and local level response as critical, and one of the most important in a federalist society like ours, where governors and tribal leaders really have most of the control in an emergency. We need to be thinking about how they are going to respond and doing more work with the National Governors Association and with the health officials associations around the country to make sure that we are not just saying, wear a mask, but we're actually providing ways to make that work in different types of communities.
Thank you. You've talked a lot about the administration's efforts. Is there a need for any legislative action to advance our preparedness, or is it only an issue of developing and executing a plan?
It's a great point. So first I'll say that Congress has done some action in this space. The new Office of Pandemic Preparedness and Response came out of a bipartisan bill that passed about a year and a half ago, and that was great to see, especially in this period of polarization. I think there is work to be done. I'll just pick one area, which is, I talked a little bit about advances in technology and their risk as well as their reward. It's actually not law that every company that creates DNA, which means people who order DNA for all kinds of peaceful purposes, most big companies screen to see who's ordering it and what are they ordering. So that, for example, you don't have somebody ordering something that you don't think they should order, or you don't have somebody ordering something even accidentally that could be dangerous. That's not legislated. So this is a small area that I think is worth considering as an improvement. And I think there's a lot of good debate about not wanting to securitize science, but there's also a lot of support, including from industry, to do some things that would help protect them as well as people. So that's just one example. I do think there's need for legislative action and financing. The global health security programs are not getting more money, they're getting less.
Here's somebody who wants to know if we're doomed to be forever either in a panic mode or a mode of neglect, but never somehow in between. Can we sustain efforts in these areas?
I like the way that the person who framed that put it. Instead of talking about panic, neglect, crisis, complacency, we talk about sustainability and sustained effort. I think it's possible, George. I think that it is completely possible to get to a sustained level of effort, but I don't think it's possible for the U.S. to do it alone. I think we have a lot of funding going to global health security. The United States is still the largest funder of these efforts and global health writ large around the world. But there are a lot of partners, including partners who are low and lower middle income, who are putting in more and more of their own funding and support, especially when they saw in the COVID pandemic that high-income countries were not always going to be there as quickly as they wanted them to be. So I think the key is having a more synergized effort. We're all coordinating, we're talking to each other, we're talking about our programs, but we're not actually synergizing around these specific metrics and sort of like holding ourselves impatiently accountable.
And there are several questions here related to actually biological weapons and biological warfare. One asks, is the U.S. still the obvious choice to lead in the efforts, initiatives against biological warfare? If not, where is the leadership in the world today?
Well, I think we are still in desperate need of being the leader to counter biological weapons. I think the United, for a number of reasons, one of which is the United States had a biological weapons program. I think it's critical for us to lead the efforts to end biological weapons as an issue if we can. But we also have an incredible biotechnology field in the U.S., and if we want to remain the leaders in biotech, and if we want to build our global bioeconomy, the best way to create a norm against misuse is to be the one setting that norm when we're developing technologies and to build in the guardrails. So I think the answer to that question is absolutely we have to be.
And then to follow up on that, why haven't we seen biowarfare given, in effect, given the current situation with multiple violent conflicts taking place?
This is a great question, and I'm glad that we haven't seen large-scale biological warfare. Of course, we've seen bioterrorism used, including at the very beginning of my career, the anthrax attacks in 2001. So I think one piece of speculation on why a country might not want to use biological weapons is because it's hard to control what happens with them. If you think about using a virus, for example, that spreads between people. But I do worry about new tools and technologies or the ability to create a targeted set of biological weapons. And I think that we should not assume that bad actors aren't looking at vulnerabilities that were exposed in countries around the world during COVID. And I think we need to be running faster to be able to detect biological weapons threats as they arise and to be able to respond effectively. I think we need to do a lot more on prevention in the Biological Weapons Convention as well.
And here's a little different type of question. A chronic illness due to infections such as COVID or Lyme disease is ruining our lives and negatively impacting productivity and economy. Why isn't there more focus on chronic illness as opposed to pandemic illness?
Well, look, there is a lot of focus on chronic illness right now with the cancer moonshot, for example, and I think there needs to be. Chronic diseases kill so many people around the world and in our country. I think the issue with pandemic threats is because they're not ever present in our lives. We can lose focus on them. It makes it harder to sustain the effort. So I'm certainly not saying that chronic diseases shouldn't get the attention that they're getting and more. But if we don't focus on pandemic threats and we don't focus on outbreaks that have the potential to cause pandemic threats, we're left in a situation where we could actually see large-scale deaths and we see a setback. For example, people weren't able to get elective surgeries. People delayed their appointments for checkups for chronic diseases, and you end up seeing an exacerbation of all of the other health threats that people face. So I think it's a both and.
And here's an easy question: relying more heavily on artificial intelligence in the future, how will this benefit or change the outcomes in creating cures and addressing health crises?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that AI is going to be incredibly important in creating a large number of technologies that can help us in the healthcare field, but specifically vaccines, tests, and treatments. So biodesign tools that are backed by artificial intelligence, I think will help us be able to know how to target a therapeutic more easily to a specific disease threat, and that's a net positive for everybody. At the same time, when we start looking at the relationship between AI, which currently large language models can aggregate a lot of information for us, but what we don't know is how AI creating biodesign tools and then ultimately linking those biodesign tools to the ability to make an agent without a human in the loop, that's where I think we need to be worried about AI and AI-related risk. And so I'm glad that there are a lot of people who are focusing on that risk, but I am worried about huge advances taking place in that middle stage that takes something out of in silico work and into the ability to actually make something without a person checking it out. So we got to watch that.
And someone else is worried about something we all should be worried about. We focused on human health. What about our animals and plants that we rely on for food? Can you comment briefly on the biological threats involving the food supply? Are there plans in place, levels of risk?
So two things that I would say about that. One is that most diseases that pop out and have the ability to cause an outbreak, an epidemic, or a pandemic come from animals. And so we have to be paying attention to the human, animal, and plant interface. I also think that it's critically important to watch diseases that are spreading that can affect our food supply and the potential for any deliberate or accidental releases that can decrease food security around the world. So that's a long way of saying that a One Health approach to pandemic preparedness is absolutely critical. And if I didn't focus enough on the animal piece of this, it wasn't intentional. It's a critical part of the work.
And is that part of the ongoing effort to look at the spread of diseases in animals? And
yes, absolutely. I will say that if you had asked me 10 years ago when we were launching the Global Health Security Agenda, if I thought that the human and animal communities were sufficiently working together on global health security, I would have said we're doing pretty well. The World Health Organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Organization for Animal Health, these are the three main international organizations that work on these issues together. They had a tripartite agreement, it's now a quadripartite agreement, adding in the environment. I would have said we're doing well. When I look at H5N1 and I look at some of the issues that are still out there around how we're going to deal with milk and how we deal with the situation that we have on farms, the challenges that people have economically in addressing these issues, I still think we have a lot of work to do, and I'm not sure we've paid enough attention to that issue, even in our own country. So there's a lot left.
You've commented somewhat on the role of the states in health security. But could you expand a little bit on the role of states and health security for the pandemic, preparedness in dealing with outbreaks, et cetera? I mean, a lot's done at the state levels and not the national level.
Yeah, so one of the findings of our work in the American Democracy and Health Security Initiative is that governors and tribal leaders are in charge. And the reason that I say that is because at the end of the day, the health sector, the public health sector, is under either governmental or local, city, or in some cases, county-level control, depending on where you are in the country. And so what that means is that the federal government can provide guidance and advice, and sometimes the federal government can put in place executive orders and mandates, and those are important. But at the end of the day, people who are in charge locally, who are elected locally, have more power. And so what that translates into is governors having a rapid way to stand up a task force that takes into account not just public health, but economic and educational impacts that needs to happen. And most of the states that we talked to got to that eventually, but it took them several weeks and sometimes longer to do that. And it means the federal government needs to be a really reliable partner in providing the tools and supplies that states need. And I think that is something the federal government does do and should do. But I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done on how to create links between states and the federal government that are more operational, that aren't one way, with the federal government saying, states, here's what you should do. Instead, let's have a problem-solving discussion together about how we can actually work together on getting tests to you more quickly or solving PPE challenges so that you're not competing with each other to buy PPE on the open market, which happened during COVID.
I think we have time for one or two more questions, and I apologize to those whose questions we didn't get to. We always run into this situation, lots of questions. Here's one. There's a vast discrepancy in resources between countries, with poor states unable to support adequate health systems. You spoke about a fund that addresses such situation. How do you provide them to these nations without raising the concerns in these nations that they're being controlled or coerced by richer states. It's a common problem among all
ages. This is top of mind right now for countries around the world, and particularly in the global south. And during the pandemic accord negotiations, this was the topic. How do we develop capacity, including the ability to make and manufacture countermeasures locally and regionally? And how do we, as we're developing things like grants from the pandemic fund, which I spoke about, how do we make sure that these grants are actually serving the needs that we have? And so the answer to that question is that low and lower middle income countries need to be at the table for these discussions and on the board, which they are. But there has to be an even more concerted effort, I think, by all donors who are putting funding in, not just to infectious disease threat prevention, detection, and response, but global health more broadly, to have the countries set the agenda for the gap. So I spoke a little bit about dashboards that we have online for this 50-country commitment the U.S. has. Those dashboards are not CDC and USAID dashboards. They're dashboards that the countries are working on in conjunction with the United States. And they need to be to fill the gaps that the country is prioritizing first. It's a challenge. It's been an age-old challenge in global health to get to a more localized way of working, but this is a huge priority for people that work in this field.
And one last question, and there's several of them, but this one's very non-political. Will the infrastructure measures you talked about be able to withstand another presidency which doesn't prioritize preparedness for pandemics?
No. No, I don't actually. I believe it will be hard. And let me put a more hopeful spin on it. One great thing about the fact that we have a federalist system in this country for things like public health is that states do have a lot of control. So actually, it really does matter who people locally elect and put in power. Your public health is reliant on the people that you vote for. So I do think it will be really hard to do a good job in the next pandemic if we don't have somebody in power who prioritizes these issues and who leans forward fast.
Thank you very, very much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, George. Thanks to all of you. This was great.